people here wanted to know about, to hear about this, and it's really work in progress. So what I'm going to do during the next 45 minutes is just to throw a lot of ideas at the wall. Okay, beforehand, I will make some formal definitions that are going to be extremely useful and can help us understand a lot of the work that has already been done in a nice framework. And then I'm going to tell you what I think are good avenues for research, and then I'm very much interested in your feedback. So what I propose after the talk, people who are interested could stay maybe here, maybe we just move to one of these open areas to have a brainstorming. If I can get your input, that would be very, very interested. So as I said, the work has been done in collaboration with people in Europe and in Asia. In Europe, so this has this work was started during my PhD with Nicolas Gisin. You have to thank him to have let me work on that, because this was not clearly like the central path of my thesis, but I feel that what we have now is really interesting. And Marc-Olivier Anou came to me. He has a very good background in finite group theory, which I did not have during my undergrad, so he helped me to understand a lot of things I was doing in a very unwavy way. Now we are working together on part of this. And Anthony Martin is an experimentalist, and what we are trying to do is to use part of these tools to apply them to experimental situation. You will see later how that plays. And now I move to Taiwan to work with Yongchen Liang, who actually will be part of the literature review a bit later. And one of the students, Peixing Lin, is looking a bit at the same thing that these two people are doing. I'm going to work in the device-independent paradigm. And what's really important here, okay, a lot of people here work with DAGs. Probably a lot of what I'm going to say generalized to DAG, but like for my training, I'm more familiar with like non-local scenarios, so this is what I'm going to consider. So we have input or measurement settings and output or measurement outcomes. What I'm going to do is not use X, Y, B. What I'm going to do is to use I and O for input outputs and use the labels of the party A, B, C as the party numbers. So every time you say A, B, C, D, is think of some numbers, but written as letters for clarity. Then what we do in this scenario, we look at the observed correlation. And one interesting observation is that by definition, this input and output should be finite. Because if you don't have any particular structure in your theory, then you don't want to consider sets where these probabilities could, the number of coefficients in this distribution could be infinite, because you would never be able to estimate them in any physical experiment. What we can do as well is enumerate these elements. You know, they are in finite dimensional vector space. And for example, for CHSH, you have bind bits, 4 bits, n equals 16. It's not surprising. What's interesting is now you can impose some kind of Galileo principle, because you work in this device-independent framework. Even if you do a CHSH test, you then completely forgot that you did a sigma z or sigma x measurement. So every law or every theory you do in that paradigm must be completely independent on the labeling of parties, input, and output. Here we already have an inventory of what relabeling we can do. We can exchange Alice and Bob, or for one specific party, we can just permute the labels of the inputs, and for one specific party input, we can relabel the output of that specific measurement. So then, of course, symmetry are widely used in other fields, like quantum field theory. Naturally, when I started to think about that, I wondered, like, what are the group structures involved? What are the representations of that group structures that are very important in QFT, but in Bell scenario, we don't think of them. Is there any physical meaning associated to those? This is what I want to explore with you. So the talk first, I'm going to give a few definitions. I think every time there is a paper with group theory in it, people working quantum information, as me, like, was really afraid to read the paper because I was quite unfamiliar with the notation. But with the like the right definition, I think it's not so bad. Then what I'm going to do is a review of the literature using the tools that we just have just defined. And then I will underline like what are the natural extensions that the author did not consider. So there are, I think, a lot of easy projects that can be extracted from this review. And then I will be talking about some new application of these tools. So let's start about definition, like what I call a Bell group, or what would be the action of that group. And then some, just define some tools that are used in finite group theory. So what's inside, we already said, we have permutation of parties. So now I'm going to use the cycle notation to write the permutation of parties, let's say. If before and I had A, B, C, now I look what's inside here, I say, okay, A goes to B, so the preimage is A, the image is B, and then you can write your permutation as a product of cycles. And here what's interesting is because I use the letters A, B, C for the parties, every time you see something in parentheses with letters, you know it's a permutation of parties. The inverse of that basic component is very easy, you just reverse the cycle. No permutation of inputs. Of course, you want to affect only a specific party, so you have to specify which one you're going to affect. And then you just, the same as before, you just write the cycle notation for the relabeling you apply there. The inverse of that element, very easy, you just reverse the cycle and of course you apply it as to the same party as before. No permutation of output. You need to specify the party and something that's not immediate, it was not immediate to me, that actually you can change the labeling for every single setting of every single input of the party. So what we are going to specify is like the affected party and input and put the cycle. And of course the inverse is very easy to take. And the effect of that is that it's going to permute the output, but only if the input is some specified, pre-specified value. So now the inventory, we have permutation of party, input, output. We have a way to compute the inverse. What's not clear is what's going to be the multiplication law of that group. What we are going to do is to define a canonical ordering of these elements. So first we write the output, then we write the input relabelings, and then finally the parties relabeling. And to rearrange these elements, we are going to use the right exponentiation notation, like we consider the right action of the group. So basically this. And then you can extract the commutation rules that you can just have a look here. Actually, because I never, with binary input outputs, it's very easy to do because there is no, you don't need to remember the order. What I did is to write a software, every time I'm confused, I just type the thing in the computer and the answer is correct. And of course, like input relabelings for different party commute and output relabeling for different party and or inputs commute as well. So now we have a multiplication rule, we have an inverse rule, it's closed, so it's a group. So let's see what happens for CHSH. So you would have two parties, two inputs, two outputs. The order of input relabelings is 2 factorial to the power 2 because you have two copies of S2. For the output, you have two copies for the parties times two copies for each input. So it's 2 factorial to the power 4. And of course, you have the party relabelings, 2 factorial. Then the group is of order 128. Now, if you go to the general case with n party, n input, k output, you can do the same computation and you find the order of that group. You see that it's going to grow to be very large quite soon as you increase the number of input parties outputs. And actually, there is a natural group structure there that you don't need to investigate, and I don't need to investigate, but it's cool to know that it has a name. It's a Vrest product. There is a nice Wikipedia page because everybody, of course, likes to cite Wikipedia in formal presentations. And it's written like with this vertical snake. Let's have a look at an example. So we've looked at the symmetry group of a scenario, but now we can look at what's the symmetry group of a particular game, like CHSH. So CHSH is like the sum of the outputs is equal to the product of the inputs. And one easy symmetry is that A and B play the same role everywhere. So you can just permute them. So this means permuting the parties. Another natural symmetry is that you can flip both outputs, whatever the input is. So you would get that group element. And there is a last one that's easy to forget. Is that you can flip the input of Bob, but of course you will get an additional A here, so you need to remove it, and the best way to do that is to ask Alice to add the value of her input to her output, which would correspond to that permutation. And if you input these three generators in the group, then you will get the CHSH group, which is of order 16. And actually, you can have a look and identify that group. It's a dihedral group of order 16. So now that we have a group, we can look at the action of that group. At the same time, like representation of action is a bit the same thing. So the easiest thing, the simplest thing that we can take is a triplet of a party, input for that party, and output for that party. So sometimes I will write the subindices of I, it's the input of that party. Sometimes we forget it, but it's always clear from the context. And of course, like the permutation of parties, you just permute the corresponding label of the party. Permutation of inputs for a specific party P, you relabel the input, but only if P is equal to uppercase P. And if you have a relabeling of output for a particular party and input, condition on the right party and input, you relabel the output. Very easy. And now physically, what does this correspond to? It corresponds to the single party margin loss. So now we have an action on these triplets, but at the same time we have an action on the single party marginal, or even like the POVM element, if you want. So, and what's very interesting is that actually this action has a name. It's the imprimitive and imprimitive action, because we have like two embeddings of its products. So if you take like the definition of the imprimitive action, you obtain directly something that's physical. And sometimes I said, like, I always forget the rules for the, especially when you have like cycles with three elements, which direction should you go? If you forget, you just look at this action is very easy not to get lost. So this is also a very useful tool to verify the multiplication of group elements. Now, if you take the primitive action, I'm not going to go into details, this corresponds to list of output and inputs, like one value of output and input for each party. At the same time, you can think of a set of triplets where you have like one for each party, like A with some value, B with some value, and so on. And you take the action of triplets on every element here, you reorder them, and you put it back there. So this is what we are going to get. Like if we have relabeling of parties, we get relabeling on the index here, of course with an inverse, because this was the element that's supposed to be at that place, so you need to take the inverse. All these kind of details that are easy to get wrong. And if you have a relabeling of inputs, then it's just that the element for the concerned party that's going to be relabeled. And if you have an output permutation, you have a relabeling of the output condition that this is the right input. And of course, the observable quantity that corresponds to this is the correlation, or the correlation. So summary, we've seen that naturally, just from the group structure, we get two physical quantities. And you can do as well the primitive action. Again, follows from the mathematical definition. And actually, you get the deterministic local strategies.
What's the distinction between primitive and imprimitive?
I can stop there and give you a summary, or we can take this question at the end. It's when you have these rest products, so it's you have copies of a symmetric group, and you have another symmetric group that permutes these copies. So for each of these symmetric group, like the base, imprimitive action means that you take a set of n elements for Sn for each of those, and then you have the overall group that's going to permute the blocks. Whereas the primitive action, you really like take this tensorial thing. So basically, for imprimitive, you have a block system, and for primitive, you don't have a block system. But now I'm going like I'm a bit unfamiliar with group theory. As I said, like I use it as a physicist, so probably we should talk to people in the finite group community. So now, of course, now we just look at action on like indices or whatever they were, tuple or set of tuple, and so on. But this gives us an action of vectors. We just say that the permuted vector for the permuted index is the original one. Like take the definition the same like people do in QFT, actually. And at the same time, you have an action, an induced action on tuples of stuff. Like if you have just n copies of an object, then you can just take the group action on every of these objects. I mention it because when you go to the NPL hierarchy, you're going to have product of projectors, and you can actually apply the symmetry group here as well by just applying the group to every projector in the list. If it's not clear, then we can discuss later. There are a few tools that we can use from group theory. First tool is orbit. So we take any element with an action, and we look at the set of all possible representative of that element under the group action. So for example, when we apply the group action to a Bell inequality, we are going to get all the representative in the Bell inequality family. We can look at the stabilizer subgroup, the subgroup of G that's going to leave some object invariant. So this is going to give us the symmetry group of a Bell inequality. As before, we computed the symmetry group of CHSH. That's exactly that. We can look at symmetric subspaces if we have a group. We just take the subspace of some vector space that the group leaves invariant. For example, if correlation symmetric under exchange of parties, that's one example of a symmetric subspace. And finally, we have the averaging map, where we just take basically the average of the orbit of some object. And this is, for example, already used when we are in the CHSH scenario. You take any correlation, you can map them to the isotropic line using a depolarizing map. This is exactly that. I use, and you don't need to know about it, but some people like to do more like programming than other. I like it very much, maybe too much. They are very efficient algorithm for permutation groups based on bases and strong generated sets. So basically, this is all the theory developed from Sharia Sims. There is an excellent book called Handbook of Computational Group Theory, mainly for finite groups. And I did an implementation of part of this algorithm in Scala. So it's now open source and online. And a slight extension of permutation group, you can consider permutation action, but at the same time, you're also allowed to multiply by a root of unity. It's like permutation matrices, but you allow, instead of ones, you can put root of unities inside. It's called monomial representation. And there is a really, really good package written by Marcus Püschel that can decompose this representation. This is going to come handy later. I don't think this package is very well known. Mm-hmm. So now let's do some like personal review of literature using all these tools. So at the beginning of the 21st century, people started to solve the local polytops for a few the scenario that were solvable. And in 2001, Pitofsky and Swozil solved the local polytop and obtained 50,000 facets. But actually, 2 years later, Sliva showed that actually you only have 46 equivalence classes under the group action that we just considered. So you don't need to give a list of people of a text file with 50,000 inequalities. You only need one representative per class. And then if you want to recover all of them, you just look at the group orbit. And actually, you know, like all the definition that we have done, what is exactly the group, what is the multiplication rule, if you have such a small group, like only 3,000 elements, you don't need to consider the multiplication rule. You just brute force through all the elements to group your families. That's what people do today. And you don't need all that baggage. You just do it the simplest way. But now that we have inequalities in scenario where the order of the group can be, I don't know, 10 to the power 60, you cannot use brute computation anymore.
Sorry, what contrast are you drawing here between brute force on the one hand and... just say it again.
We've seen before that any relabeling can be written as a product of output relabelings, input relabeling, party relabelings. So it's very easy to enumerate all elements of the group. So if I want to group my 50,000 facets in classes, I just need to take the 3,000 group elements and just map them one by one and make the and build my equivalence classes. But for example, if I have a few inequalities in a much bigger scenario and I want to check if some of them are equivalent, I cannot, of course, do the iteration 10 to the power 60 times. So I need a more complex algorithm that's going to just check, for example, if two inequalities are equivalent. That's what I want to say. People did not care so much about a formal definition of the group, because if the scenario is small, then you just do it the simplest way, and it works. So actually, Sliva, maybe it came before, but it's one of the first people to use really this correlator notation, which is extremely good for binary outcomes. So, you know, you write the output as plus and minus one values, and you look at the average of the product of those, And for example, for this scenario with three parties, then you have some kind of cube, where what I have in purple here is the tripartite correlators and these four 2x2x1 rectangles would be the two-body correlators, and then you have the single-party marginal plus normalization. So you have a nice way to decompose the any inequality. And what we are going to see later is that actually this generalizes to more outputs. And I think it's an important step. Another thing that's part of the folklore, and I didn't know it, so I moved to Tainan a few months ago, and my colleague Yong Chan told me, but actually what you are doing with the NPA, we already did it like 8 years ago for the symmetry, for symmetries under permutation of parties. So I'm just going to be very brief because this is not an introduction to the NPA hierarchy. So imagine that you build the hierarchy just for Q1, and you have the projector for Alice and for Bob, but actually the inequality you want to test is symmetric under the permutation of AB. So now you can apply the symmetry, the averaging map to every object in that scenario, including this matrix. And then you're going to get that U is equal to V and that V is equal to V transpose. And once you've done that, then you reduce a lot the dimension of that space. But you can do even better. You can, and this is already known, this is part of the folklore. What you can do is to now block diagonalize the matrix by considering like U plus V and U minus V, and you have a symmetric transformation from these two. So this such that the anti-diagonal block are zero. And this is going to be much more efficient for solving SDPs. Another trick, and I think this one is also quite interesting, can be extended. Sometimes we have scenario where the conversion from the vertex representation of the local positop to the facet or inequality representation is too hard. So what Bancal and collaborators considered, you take a subgroup of the Bell group. So again, they only use permutation of parties, not the rest of the group structure. You apply the averaging map to your vertices. So now you end up with a polytop in a subspace. And the polytop is actually smaller than the original polytop and much easier to solve. So now you can do the conversion to the half space representation. But now if you want to write your inequalities in the original space, you also, this averaging map, it's actually a projector, like just a matrix. So you can, of course, write your averaging map here. So now you have inequalities that are valid in the original space, and some of them are going to be facet. So it's interesting, something non-intuitive here. We go to a smaller polytop, we solve it, but when we move back and we introduce this averaging map, we get a polytop that's larger, and some of the facets are going to coincide, which can be checked, and they produce, I don't know, 30,000 inequalities. So it can be quite efficient. The natural extension here is not only to consider symmetry under permutation of parties, but to impose some kind of symmetry. I did not write it down, but some of you know this guess your neighbor input inequality. And here, every time you relabel the input of one party and the output of the neighboring party at the same time, you have a symmetry. So we could generate a lot of this guess your neighbor input inequality using the same process. I did not do it, so it's like a small project to do. I would also mention the work of Jordi Tura, what he considered like to build inequalities for a lot of systems, considering symmetry under permutation of parties and imposing that the inequalities have two-body correlators. So a lot is already done, but only for party permutations. And I want to mention three papers that appeared and happened to stumble upon them. So the idea is that you can construct a Bell inequality starting from a group. So you start in the quantum world, and then you bring this inequality to the non-locality framework. So what you do, you take the irreducible representation of a group. I'm not working on that. It's just pure advertisement for the work that they did, which is interesting. You take an irreducible representation of dimension D, and you take two bras in a Hilbert space such that both orbits can be grouped into orthonormal bases. So these orthonormal bases, they are going to be the component of measurements. Then you look at the POVM element, and you apply the averaging map of course, you're going to take D tensor D. And then you're going to get a sum. And you think of this sum as a Bell operator, and then you get for free a Bell inequality and a set of candidate states and measurements to violate that Bell inequality. Just advertisement. I don't know much of this work, and just encourage you to go look at the paper. Yes?
Are these passive
deployment? I don't know. I did not look very much into that. But I find it interesting that they go completely the opposite way. Like, instead of trying getting a Bell inequality and then trying to find violation, you start with a group, find some state and measurement, and then you construct after the fact a Bell inequality, which is why I wanted to advertise this work. Now I'm going to move in some application and ideas that I did. I don't know how much time remains. 15 minutes, perfect. So the first thing was to use these tools to classify Bell inequalities. So just we have two main degeneracies in Bell inequalities when we formulate them. The first one is that they are trivial equalities. For example, P is normalized, so if I sum over the outputs, then what if I take any input pair minus any other input pair, it's always going to give me zero. So now what I can do is I take the coefficient of my Bell inequality and I add some constant factor of this coefficient there, not going to change my inequality, but it can make my inequality look very different. And this is a problem when you want to classify inequalities. And of course you have the non-signaling conditions. But one thing that's going to save us is that if you take any correlation that's non-signaling, any relabeling of that correlations will be as a non-signaling. So this hints that we have irreducible representation in this P. Okay. They will stay in the same surface under the group action. So what can we do now? So what we do, because now we know that we have an irreducible representation or sum of irreducible representation that correspond to the non-signaling subspace, we can project the coefficient in that subspace and then apply any relabeling, and we know that if we go the other way around, it's compatible. So it's very good. It means that we can remove the degeneracy due to the signaling part of the space and then remove the degeneracy that's because of the group action, and both are going to be compatible. So the process is that we first project the inequality, then we select some enumeration order of the coefficient. This is completely arbitrary. And then what you do, you just enumerate all the coefficients and you sort them in the lexicographic order and you pick the first one. So you're going to tell me, oh, but if my inequality has 10 to the power of 30 representative, I cannot store them in memory. But actually, you don't store them. You can just walk the tree. You have some decomposition of the group that enable you to compute this representative very efficiently. And I encourage you to have a look. Unfortunately, it's a work in progress since 2 years, because we quickly made a prototype, and now I want to make it correct. But we have a website here, and you can take, for now, a few papers, but with Jean-Daniel, we entered at least 35 papers from the literature, and you would have access to the coefficient of the Bell inequality, and then you can look at the decomposition, how do you go from this inequality to the canonical representative that would be in the database. And already some people use the tool to identify that the inequality they are working on actually was already known in the literature under a different name. Okay, I'm going to continue to work on that software, but this is really long-term work. Another thing, and that's quite interesting, is to look at so we have a group action, and so representation of the group on the P, A, B, X, Y, and it's a permutation representation. So immediately we know that the vector 1, 1, 1, 1, 1, 1, 1 is going to be an irreducible representation of the group. So it means we can split it. And what's very interesting is that actually when you write the correlator notation, it's exactly that. It's a decomposition of the space of the PABXY into irreducible representation. Let's just have a look. If the distribution is normalized, after relabeling, it's normalized. If the marginals, the one-body marginals are zero, or uniform, after relabeling, they will be uniform. The same for the two-body correlators. If they are random, then after relabeling, they will be random, and then remains the full correlator part. And so to understand what is the part missing, because this is not the full story, I'm going to go back to a simpler example, which is CHSH. And of course, if we write the correlator for CHSH, here we have like dimension 16 and here dimension 9, which means that something is missing there. And actually, what's missing? You have normalization. So in your P, A, B, X, Y, like whatever pair of X, Y, you have four of them, you sum, you get one. So it means that you have four dimensions of normalization. And you have four dimensions of signaling. Because Alice can signal, Bob can signal his input to the first input of Alice or to the second input of Alice or both. And the same from Alice to Bob. Here I've written them in a different color, but of course these two are part of the same irreducible representation because we have the permutation of parties. Now what's interesting, when you write a Bell inequality, some kind of scalar product, because we can move from one representation to another using the blocks will still be orthogonal. So if our P in that representation is non-signaling, it's going to have coefficient zero all over here. So it means that whatever inequality I take, I can force this coefficient to be zero. Because anyway, like the scalar product of this and this is always going to be zero. So that's the way to remove the degeneracies due to the signaling subspace. But what's interesting is that we are going to take, to keep the coefficient in the original space, in the probability representation, because this is where we have the efficient algorithm. And we can apply like the computational group theory. So I don't have the time now to talk about all. So of course we have a decomposition into irreducibles, but we can apply the same if our output are not binary. So we'll get something else than these binary correlators. And what's very interesting is that we have a lot of properties that are known when we can write things with binary correlators, especially when the Bell inequality is full correlator. For example, we have the result from Werner and Wolf. We have Thielson theorem that you only need to go to some level of the SDP hierarchy. There are also quite cute results by Wu and Zukovsky, how to extend Bell inequalities with binary correlators from, let's say, two parties to three parties, four, five, six, seven, in a very in a nice algebraic way. So I wonder, like, using generalized correlators, how many of these results will generalize. Next, so we have seen before that when correlations are non-signaling, then we can always set the signaling space of the inequality to zero. What happens in experiments, we use finite samples. This is actually there's quite a bit of discussion about the recent experiments, especially the one done in Delft, because they are very low statistics. So it means that whatever you do, your distribution is going to be slightly signaling. And then computing the CHSH bound or the CH bound is not going to give you the same result. So what we've done here is to simulate the effect of, let's say, 10,000 experiments. And we took the point, the same point as used in the Delft experiment. And we looked at what would be the distribution of the value of the inequality. And this is actually what people do when they want to estimate, okay, now everybody is using p-values, but before that, they would estimate the sigma. And what's very interesting, you have exactly the same experimental data, or the same experiment. If you apply two different inequalities, you don't get the same sigma. Here you see that basically you cannot say anything. And if you use the right inequality, then it's quite clear that you have a violation. And always I thought, okay, CHSH is the one that we obtain after we remove the signaling subspace, so it's the optimal one. And Marc-Olivier and Anthony in Geneva, actually they see that the exactly how you tailor this signaling coefficient depends on the correlation you expect in the experiment. Of course, you don't want to take the best inequality after the fact because you would violate a statistical principle. But if you know beforehand that your distribution is going to be around here, then you can take the best inequality.
Question. Yeah? Should the S quantity on top be CHSH and the S quantity on the bottom be CH?
No.
This seems to be a mismatch because you have the definitions of the...
Oh, yes. These two are... this one should be there and this one should be there. Yeah, correct.
So the one that does well is CHSH?
It's CHSH, yeah, in that graph.
And the one that does
so this corresponds to this graph, but these two should be exchanged. All the definitions are correct, but link this one with this one and this one with this one.
Right. So the moral of the story is CHSH is better in CloudTrail-born at detecting.
Yeah. Yeah, here. But if you take, for example, the Christensen experiment or the one done in Vienna, it's exactly the reverse. So it's quite interesting. But I'm like, they worked on their own. I'm going to visit them next week. So it's like a work in progress. Now, the last part, NPR relaxation. So people already used the symmetrization to actually go to problems where we don't have the memory or CPU time to solve them. And here I'm going to solve to show that if you really use the full symmetry group of the inequality, not only symmetry under permutation of parties, then you can obtain even exact results. So the simplest example is CHSH. And I use here the formulation with binary correlators. And then you look at the symmetry group that we defined before for the game. And you're going to obtain, for example, that A0 is equal to B0 because of the permutation of parties. And A0 equal to A1 and B0 equal to B1 because of this flip input of one party and do the correction on the output of the other one. And then you apply this on your matrix and you're going to actually remove a lot of the dimensionality because just a single variable remains. Then what you can do, you have now a ring of matrices that are symmetric under group action. And you know that you can decompose this ring. And for that, you need to decompose the representation of the symmetry on the symmetry group on the vector 1, A0, A1, B0, B1, which you can do, and you get three representations. One is of dimension 1, two are of dimension 2. And we have no multiplicities. And this is very important. Every time you have multiplicities, you're going to get block of size 2, 3, 4, 5. If you just have single multiplicities, then you're going to get blocks of size 1 by 1. And a SDP with 1 by 1 blocks is a linear program. Now, there is a trick. Like we no longer have a rational coefficient in our SDP. We are going to get something coming from the... basically, the matrix that takes this representation to this one, but luckily, like all group, final group representation can be written using roots of unity, you know, like cycloatomic numbers. So I've written a package to compute with cycloatomic numbers fast. So now I can basically do the linear program here and get the result. So 2√2 for CHSH. And well, so this is already known, like you can do CHSH even without the symmetries for full correlators, like basically. Using Searle's theorem, and you can compute the arc sine, blah, 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 bound. But this is a new result. You take CGLMP for three outputs, Q1. So now you have to go to the full correlator. So I have a list here, it's cut. You look at the generator of the group, which is of order 24. It's also a dihedral group. And you do the reduction. With us considering the block diagonalization, only six variables will remain. And because we use the full set of projectors, you, of course, have equality constraints. So they will translate into equality constraint on your variables. So basically, you have only three dimensions. Now you do the block diagonalization, you get one by one blocks, and you can compute the value that was until now only numerical. So I'm writing the software to do this automatically. Now I can only do like Q1, but I want, of course, to go higher. And of course, to find the decomposition of the representation into irreducibles, this is where the software by Marcus Puchel is invaluable. Because in general, the problem is difficult to solve. But here's a software, provided you have a permutation representation and your group is solvable, which is OK when your number of input-output parties is less than or equal than 4, then you can do it. OK, so I think it's time to conclude. So what we have seen is that if we really have a full understanding of the symmetries in correlation scenario, just opens a lot of avenue of research. It's useful for classification. This is like bookkeeping. I'm going to finish that website, but it's not going to make Nature or PRL, but it's nice work for everybody. I would be curious is like, can we extend the tricks that we know already? Just need to think of what we can do with binary correlators and try to extend them. We've seen that it adds robustness to many things, like when we compute the SDP bounds, now we can do them, some of them exactly, but even if the resulting SDP after block diagonalization is not diagonal, it's still going to be much better numerically. For experiments as well, we can select the best inequality for a particular scenario. And what I hope to get out of that is like a deeper theoretical understanding. I think I have fragments of that, but there is a lot that remains. So thanks for your attention, and I'm waiting for your input. So I don't know if you have a question or if like a group of us should move to open practice. This is like, it's not going to promote collaboration to have like this kind of divide in the room. So maybe I propose like if there are like clarification about the talk, I take this question now, and after that, like Rob and Matthew or Eli, you can organize or we should do the rest of the discussion. So any questions? Yeah.
So I was a bit curious about something you said at some point that you have efficient algorithms for the list of probabilities, but not for the correlators.
You mean you mean the group algorithm?
Right.
The trick. I don't know if I answered the question, but let me try to do it. So if you have a group. That's a permutation group. It's very easy to decompose that group in what people call a stabilizer chain. So what you do is you take your group G, and you look at the, so that would be 1, 2, 3, 4, and so on. And now you look at decomposing G in using G1, the group that fixes the first element. And now it's any element of that group you can write using a finite number of group elements plus an element of the stabilizer. And you repeat that, basically. So now you decompose that one, the one that's going to fix 1 and 2. So you get like this 1, 2. And you do it until you get the trivial group. And now you have a way to write every element of the group as a product. And the number, every time, the number of possible elements that can go in the product is just the orbit size of the element that you want to stabilize under the group action. So this is the base of this algorithm. And this is why, for example, I can find this minimal lexicographic representative very quickly. Because what I do, I look at the first coefficient of the inequality. With this decomposition, I know how many values from the coefficient I can bring there. I just take the group elements that give me the minimal value there, and now I move to the second one using the stabilizer and so on, which is very nice. But now if you move to other representation, for example, people use Collin-Gisin, when you want to relabel outputs, every time you want to move the output that's not there, you need to do 1 minus 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 minus, and now instead of having nice permutation, you need to do arithmetic. Now you have a matrix group, which is much more difficult to handle. So people, when people work with matrix group, most of the time they will find a permutation representation and work in a nice representation instead. So I don't know if I answered the question.
I think so. It's basically just that it's permutation.
Yeah.
Are the correlators this other type of representation where you have groups of
inputs? Okay, correlators, they are nice for binary outputs because flipping the output, so if you have A0 and you flip the output, you get minus A0.
Right.
So binary output is still nice. But when you go to tree outcomes, then you have generalized correlators. So basically, okay, let me show it. For correlators, what you get is the transformation basically of your probabilities with the Hadamard matrix. The first line is going to give you the normalization. The second line is going to give you the correlator. But when you go to more outcomes, you can still do something like that, but it's not unique. So what you're going to do, the first line is still the normalization, but now you have a lot of freedom how to specify the rest. So you can take, for example, 2 minus 1 minus 1 and 0, 1 minus 1. This is a perfectly fine basis for correlators. But now, if you want to permute outputs, you need to do again arithmetic. So, efficient algorithm, yes, for binary outputs, no, but then if you go to higher number of outputs, you need to really work in the probability space. So, this is why for the SDPs, binary outcomes, I use the core littles, and for ternary outcomes, I need to go back to the probabilities. Yeah.
So your symmetries are clearly not physical operations, because you know swapping Hasse bob in the context of the Bell experiment is not a physical operation. It's an abstract representation of transformations you can do on that mathematical object.
Yeah, yeah.
For that reason, I see no reason why you wouldn't be able to conclude other symmetries. So you have, for example, permute the outputs for a given input and party.
Yeah.
But you can also have permute the inputs for a given output. The fact that the inputs causally influence the outputs, but not vice versa, mm-hmm. is irrelevant.
Oh.
And yeah. Unless I'm mistaken, that example, you could also have, you know, permute the parties for a given input and output, and I think there's a broader set of symmetries you could study. Yeah. But the one I mentioned where you permute the inputs for a given output, I think is especially interesting if you want to extend these sorts of techniques to proofs of contextuality. Because there you might say, okay, I have a projector that's in common with two bases, mm-hmm. and there's a symmetry wherein the probability of that output is the same regardless of whether it's this basis or that basis. And I think that would naturally correspond to mm-hmm. changing the input for a given output.
Yeah, agree. Actually, why we don't consider these kind of symmetries, because even a permuting Alice and Bob can be done in principle in a local way. Like if you have a local model, then you can always duplicate all the resources and then include a flag in the lambda to say that this time you are Alice, you are Bob, and the next step you are Bob, you are Alice. And this corresponds to the physics, but like really you have to think of locality as well. For example, when you go to n local scenarios, you cannot permute parties arbitrarily. Actually, you cannot permute them, and you can only apply the symmetries, like these averaging maps, that can be where you can include a flag in some local variable that's distributed between a subset of properties. So everything that I said here, it's really tailored for like Bell scenarios, but if we go to more complicated DAGs, then I don't know what exactly is the answer.
So are you just saying, of these more general symmetries that one could have, one finds that only some of them are symmetries relevant for the quantum correlations we see.
Yeah.
So in n local scenario, it's just the two cycles between the continuous pairs.
It depends on the graph of sources and parties.
Right.
And of course, contextuality has a different structure. So
you could start with the longer list, and then depending on whether you're doing contextuality or by locality or whatever it is, then you say which of these are relevant and which are not.
Yeah, yeah. But for now, let's say I'm really focused on standard locality because don't feel that I understood the problem space very well. So
in the standard locality scenario, can you tell me why it is not interesting to look at permutations of the inputs for a given output?
Basically, if you did that, so you, if you look at the response functions, they sum to one. So you would have like this P O A given I A lambda, and you have the sum of O A equal to one, but you don't have the sum of I A equal to one. So this is really, and you have this condition for every IA, which means that you can relabel the OA inside a particular IA, but you cannot mix different elements. Like, I don't think like saying that I relabel the input if for this particular output. I would have to look at exactly what we mean by that in terms of the action on the tuples, because this is the basic object. And to check that or local response function, for example, even the distribution that we have are still properly normalized after this group action.
Yeah, I'm not sure that's necessary. Like, shouldn't I be able to express a particular symmetry which says that, you know, for input 1, output 0, and input 2, output 0, I always get the same probability? That kind of symmetry feels like a sort of thing you ought to express.
Uh-huh.
And it's not irrelevant because there are certain proofs of non-locality that are built on top of quotient spectrum measurements at a local region, right? So it's like a Q-trid on each side, and I've got a quotient spectra set, and it's really the case that as I change my settings, you know, a certain outcome for one setting and a certain outcome for another setting,
So yes, so let's look at that because I really want to look into it. Why? Because you know, I will take a different example, and I think it's going to join what you say. If you look at lifting of belt inequalities,
liftings.
It's what's a lifting? Okay, there is a mathematical definition, but basically, what I'm going to say is that every time you have a belt inequality, let's say that Alice has for certain input, Alice has three outputs, 0, 1, 2. But the inequality is invariant under the diction of 0, 1, whatever the input is.
Under the what?
The relabeling of 0 and 1.
We did, yeah.
So physically it means that we don't care if it's a 0 or 1. Mm-hmm. So what you can do now is to say that, okay, this is going to be output 0 prime, mm-hmm. and now I have an inequality only for binary output. Mm-hmm. And okay, what Stefano Pironio showed is that if you have such a lifting, it's always, if it was a facet in the simplest scenario, it's still going to be a facet in the more complex scenario. And then what I thought of, so here the relevant symmetries, they are like permutation of outputs. And then I thought that for non-signaling boxes, the same should appear. We should have liftings. If you take the PR box and you go to the scenario with three output and three inputs, we should have like lifting of that box. But in the probability space, it's what very relevant to say that I'm going to sum of this output and this output in the same way, because we don't have the prime of normalization. Whereas for non-signaling boxes, I think the natural thing is to do exactly the reverse. Well, when we want to add an output, so here, when we do a lifting and we add an output, we just duplicate the coefficient. And when we add an input, we just discard the result of that particular input. And I think for non-signaling boxes, it's exactly going to be the reverse. You add one output, never going to use it. You add an input, you do exactly the same as you would do for another input. And what I wondered always is like, here it can be described by the symmetry group I considered, and it seems that for the dual object, like the non-signaling box, it cannot. So now I think I have a path. If indeed we can work something from what you said, then I'm sure we can explore this duality. I'm very curious.
Yeah, so this lifting is just, I think in this case, a rank two projector. The outcome is just any pair of outcomes in a rank two projector space.
Yeah, so exactly, in the quantum case, you just have like, so indeed, like if the thing was local before, it's going to be local after. If you have some quantum measurement before, then you can just, or sum them, or just do like this POVM that would answer half the first output, answer so half the time the second output. And so. I don't know if there are other questions.
So if you have access to a stable logic chain, this is just continuing on previous line of questions, you have a set of extremal vertices for deterministic local strategies.
Yeah.
And you're trying to get a particular bound bar. Right? So
yeah.
You have this set of vertices and you're building your inequalities from in such a way that you find the first coefficient first and then it's coefficient by coefficient.
Yeah.
And how
No. What I do is I take an inequality that I know already from the output of some particular solver. Mm-hmm. I don't do the converse sum of quality up under symmetry. This is a different problem. So what I do is really, you give me an inequality and I find a representative by looking at, so I look in the orbit of that particular inequality that I know, which one is the minimal representative. But there is also a related question. If you have access to the stabilizer chain and you do the transformation of polytops, then you can always check that the object that you get, like for example, facet, is the minimal representative under the action of the group. And this is what exactly software like Panda or Simple are doing, like always checking that they don't do the work twice, thrice for when doing a transformation.
The second step in the SCP simplification, when you plot that along.
Yeah.
So now you're finding some map which acts on the matrix and makes it diagonal. Right?
I have two things. So the first thing is that I project the matrix So basically I say, oh, if I have some quantum realization of that matrix, I can always include a flag in the quantum state to say to the parties, for example, this time you're Alice, this time you're Bob, and this time you're Bob, you're Alice. And of course, if my row A is not symmetric, then I include a copy of row BA as well. So then if I can violate my inequality with an asymmetric state, then I can, of course, violate it with a symmetric state of that form, with this flag. So this is what I do to just project the matrix, still going to be the same dimension, project the matrix in this lower dimensional subspace. But the matrix is still n by n, but in the basis of the space of matrices, I remove a lot of elements. Then what I can do, because this matrix is now in this low dimension, and I have a ring of matrices, I can ask, is there, if the matrix chi is positive semi-definite, then whatever matrix, let's say V, I take, it's exactly the same condition. Why? Because if I had a negative eigenvalue for the previous one, provided V is invertible. So I don't need to be unitary or symmetric. The thing that I need is that this is invertible, so I can still do the check for the eigenvalue because just not to pass it through this matrix V. So the idea is to find such a matrix such that my matrix is as block diagonal as possible. And then as an additional bonus, I can use Shor lemma to check that depending on the representation I get, some blocks are going to be the same, so I can just remove them. And the thing that's painful is not the dimension of the representation. The thing painful is the multiplicities of the representation. So you can think of why it's the multiplicities. If I have the trivial group, the only representation I get is the trivial one. So if my matrix is n by n, I'm going to have n copies of the trivial representation. And this is not going to block diagonalize anything. So we want to find higher, the highest representation we can decompose. So of course, then there is the question, what level of the hierarchy induce which representation? What are the best groups to have like exact SDP and so on? But I didn't have the time yet to investigate.
All right, thank you, David.
Thank you.